recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it on your iPod, iPad, or MP3 player, any device, and then decide to hit play. Today we have a real interesting show on the topic of the taxation of e-discovery costs, or put another way, how a winning party might recover some of the costs they expend processing data in an electronic discovery case. This issue was brought to everyone's attention last year in the Race Tires of America case from the Third Circuit, which the trial court originally imposed a hefty $300,000 bill on the party who'd had their case dismissed for e-discovery costs, which were incurred by the parties defending the case. And this award was substantially reduced on appeal, but some of the costs were awarded. Given the skyrocketing vendor costs in e-discovery, this area has been one which e-discovery lawyers have been talking about over the past year. There's a split among courts on the awarding of e-discovery costs to the winning party, and we'll be discussing the argument for awarding costs to attempt to recoup processing fees and how to frame this argument in your case, and we'll go through some of the technical steps to preserve an argument for awarding costs in case a decision is made to try and recover costs at the end of the case. And I'm pleased to say our guest for today's show, Mark Austrian, who's an e-discovery attorney and partner at Kelly Dry & Warren, is also the author of an article published on June 2012 called Taxation of Costs and Offer of Judgment, published by For the Defense, a DRI publication. Mark Austrian's a partner in the Kelly Dry & Warren's Washington, D.C. office. He focuses his trial practice on litigation, mediation, and arbitration proceedings, including matters in intellectual property, toxic tort, products liability, customs, telecommunications, commercial, environmental law areas. He also specializes in issues relating to document retention in anticipation of litigation and e-discovery. He served as a law clerk in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York from 1970 to 71. Mark also serves on the Georgetown Law School eDiscovery Advisory Board. He's an adjunct professor of law at the American University Washington College of Law, where he teaches a course in trial advocacy in the high-tech courtroom, as well as a course on eDiscovery. And he speaks and writes on eDiscovery topics nationally, including most recently this issue of cost recovery. Mark, glad to have you on the show. And first of all, I always like to ask our guests, how did you first get interested or started in electronic discovery?
Well, I got started in it really in a backwards kind of way. I've been interested in the electronic organization and transmittal of information in connection basically with trials and how do we convey information to juries. And in that connection, you think now about putting everything up on a monitor so people can see things. Working backwards, all right, I've got a lot of electronic information. How do I organize it and manage it to prepare for trial? Or electronic case management, and we're talking now about databases. Well, then, if you're interested in that, you've got to go back and figure out how is information actually maintained at your clients? How do they organize it? And the process of producing that to opposing party is a critical aspect. And in order to do the trial work that I like, I have to understand the e-discovery or the transmittal of electronic information from a client to an opposing party. It's just an essential step in litigation these days, and that got me very much interested in it.
Yeah, I agree. I enjoy going as far back as I can when I talk to companies, to record managers even, and learning about their frustrations and challenges of managing their information. And it's the boiler room. And, very interesting to hear that progression. Let's talk now about the topic today, about the costs incurred by parties in e-discovery. In April, the RAND Institute for Civil Justice released a study of 8 companies and their litigation costs in 57 cases they examined from these large companies. We did a podcast with them a couple weeks ago. But, you know, the costs were, you know, per case were tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars. So these can add up quite quickly for a company with hundreds of active cases. They're just matters where litigation is reasonably anticipated. You know, Mark, what's your sense of the cost side of e-discovery from your experiences in research?
The cost side of e-discovery has now become a major, major component in our cases in ways that they hadn't before. Just the raw costs going forward in a case are huge, and attorneys aren't really equipped, at least starting out, to figure out how to manage these costs. So what has happened is that in so many of my cases, especially patent cases, you are not litigating on the merits of the matter. You're litigating on the issues relating to the production of electronic information. The other thing that is often not clear in connection with what we talk about e-discovery is that companies, especially those that are involved in a lot of litigation, have got to reorganize their internal processes, regardless of the case, to deal with how they manage information. What are their document retention policies? What are their policies on litigation holds? So these are additional costs that, while not strictly related to litigation, still are costs the company must maintain. You have companies now that have their own e-discovery counsel because they need to have IT people and lawyers talk to each other, because all of the information is collected and maintained in very, very different places. We've got now tweets and Facebook and all sorts of other places where it's located. Well, these are all company costs for managing information. The RAND study you mentioned was important to note that processing costs, while they're expensive, and we're going to hopefully talk about that a bit more, the major cost for companies, which is in its expanding, are the cost of actually reviewing these documents. And that is because it must be done by attorneys. And not only must they be reviewed for the substance, but also for privilege. That's a huge cost. So it's growing. Everybody agrees that the amount of information that companies are maintaining is growing continuously every year. And somehow the legal system has got to catch up with that, or else, frankly, it basically destroys our system because we never get to trial. We're just so much involved in e-discovery that we cannot afford, or companies cannot afford, to bring legitimate disputes to trial because they're so costly. And that is a severe disruption of our legal system.
All right, Mark, you're depressing everyone here. So let's get to some of the good news, or at least the premise of the article. And your premise is that the recovery of some of these costs is consistent with the 2006 amendments to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. What makes you draw this conclusion?
The federal rules were specifically amended to deal with electronic discovery and the increasing costs that were there. They changed the language of the cost recovery rules. I think that the courts, many have and will in the future, begin to understand that when we say costs of copying materials in the world we live in now, that is really the cost of processing these materials so they can be exchanged in an intelligent way. I think that is where the rules are going, and it's where they have to go, so that the parties will clearly understand that if they lose the case, that there are financial consequences. So before you even start the case, and as you're managing the case, understand that if you lose and you've made unreasonable requests, you're going to have to pay for it.
And is this only for this argument really work with frivolous cases or unreasonable requests, or is there a chance to recover costs in all cases?
This is for all cases. There is no discussion within the rules for cost recovery as to whether it was a fair or an unfair request. You get into the discussion about whether the request was unfair or too expensive or out of proportion, proportionality being the word that we use, before the taxation of costs. Taxation of costs does not involve whether something was reasonable within certain limits. Like most generalities, that's false. But technically, it's whatever the copying costs are.
Okay, so let's go through the technical analysis of how to recover costs. Walk us through this, if you could.
Well, the first thing is to know clearly the law in your jurisdiction, because this is one area where the law has been changing dramatically over time. And then the next step, clearly, is to understand what these costs are. All too often, when we think of e-discovery costs, we kind of put them all together in terms of a vendor. Much of the cost of processing of information is done by third-party service providers. And you've got to very clearly understand the services that the vendor is providing, because some courts in particular jurisdictions will allow the recovery of costs, for example, processing information into what they call a TIFF format. Other jurisdictions say no. Some jurisdictions allow you to get the cost of databases. You've got to know what the courts are saying and then begin to keep the records of what these costs are. They cannot be just aggregated and given to the other side as costs. I think also you have to be sure you tell the other side that these are costs that you are going to be asking for at the end of the case, so they understand what's going on here as well. And that may oftentimes lead to a resolution of the matter, because you're putting the other side at risk. I think those are the basic things to start out with in terms of recovering your costs.
And in the article you talked about the Federal Rule Civil Procedure 54D1 and also 28 U.S.C. Section 1920, the statute, with sort of an analysis that at least the statute described the taxable costs and went through what, at the time the statute was written, all the costs that were incurred, in a litigation. So now we're in a newer era. Do you think a lawyer has to make the argument, once they're at the point of making the argument, that this statute was intended to recover costs and now we have got a new way of doing it?
Yes, and I think the 2006 amendments gives you the argument. Remember that the statute, subsection 4, originally said that you get the costs of making copies of papers. That's the day when we used to make photocopies. It's replaced it with the words costs of making copies of any materials. That was done specifically in recognition of the costs of producing electronic information, as were other amendments to the federal rules. So I think there is a legitimate, and in my case, my view, persuasive argument that we are in a new world, and we have to look at costs through the prism of the current situation and how information is kept, and not through when the discovery rules started in the 30s. So I think that's where the argument starts, and it's also a common sense argument when we think of what copying is, copying meaning the reproduction and transmittal of information. So that is at least the where I start out in the analysis, and where the courts clearly are grappling with that.
Yeah, so you did mention something which I thought was really interesting about how attorneys have not done such a great job of capturing costs. I mean, I think back in the day, which isn't so long ago, where even the lawyer bills were bills for professional services rendered. And as I've talked to vendors over time, and we've done podcasts on the pendulum between law firm and vendor, one of my guests had originally come up with a theory that the reason why companies started hiring their own vendors was they weren't getting the cost breakdown information from their law firms to to figure out even how to manage this. Why was this ship hitting an iceberg? You know, what's going on? So, I mean, your sense is that the law firms should almost be like cost accountants in this space and really make sure they're capturing this information in by task?
It's incredibly important. Look, as any litigator will tell you, as the case goes on, things get chaotic. You are worried about many, many different things. What is the opposing party's theory? What is your theory? Who are their witnesses? Just many, many things. Closer you get to the trial, especially in courts that have rocket dockets, your attention is simply not focused on accounting for costs. You don't think about it. You don't think about taxation of costs at all. You're much more worried about the upcoming case, the development, and the trial. So lawyers simply don't focus on it. Everybody is guilty. It is only when you start preparing the cost request that you begin to see that your accounting records are lousy and that you can't differentiate among costs which are recoverable against those that are not. The world is changing. Because these costs are not simply Xeroxing costs, they're much more sophisticated costs, you've got to break them out. Part of this is also where law firms are trying to do more of the processing internally, viewing this as a profit center. They have simply got to recognize that they must, as you say, be like accountants, or their systems have got to differentiate between these different costs. Or they're doing a disservice to their clients.
Yeah, I love the argument and the analysis. And after reading the article and looking at the statute, I mean, it just seems like it's there for a good lawyer to make this argument if they've got the data to back it up. So let's talk about the old way of doing it. Let's talk about photocopying costs. I mean, these are clearly recoverable. So why don't parties just make photocopies in e-discovery?
Well, if you think about it for a moment, I think most of the studies that have been done show that 90% to 90% of all the records that companies have now are in electronic format. So whereas before, you already had them in a hard copy, if you will, in a filing cabinet, that's not where they are. So if you want to think of the old way now, what you would do is get the electronic information and transfer into a paper copy. The problem with that is that the electronic information doesn't go on paper. It is all sorts of background information called metadata that just doesn't get copied. So you can't just photocopy stuff. And the courts have made it abundantly clear, as do the federal rules, that if your information is stored electronically, you can't just copy the visual information and not produce the information that you can't really see. So the whole idea of photocopying just is completely by the boards for companies. That's not how they keep their records. That's not how they maintain their information.
You know, I'm thinking back to a Georgetown conference. I think it was 2 years ago, and I'm thinking it was Judge Facciola, but it might not have been. It might have been someone else. But they were talking about citing the surveys of all the lawyers that are opting out of e-discovery. This is a couple of years ago, and how most litigations were still being run the traditional way. I mean, these are smaller law firms a lot of the time, but there's this whole group of people, lawyers, that have opted out of e-discovery. And, you know, the premise was that sort of unethical because of this hidden data that you couldn't even access to make the argument to help your client sometimes if your evidence is in electronic format. But it almost seems to me bizarre that those lawyers could recover costs for paper for doing something that, you know, the progressive judges are saying is unethical. So it almost seems like the argument is if you could recover those costs, you should be able to recover these, because otherwise we're creating a disincentive to do e-discovery.
Well, I think that's right, and they're not doing a good service to their client. Even a small case, if you are going behind a document, that may be very, very critical information. And that's all the more true when we're dealing with stuff like Facebook, which has, in many cases, got very valuable information. What lawyers were doing, where they were concerned they didn't know what they were doing. And so both sides would have kind of a silent agreement that if you don't ask me for all the background you discover in emails, which will cost your client a lot of money and cost you a lot of time, and you don't ask me for this information, then it's okay. Well, it's not okay, because you've got a duty to your client to get information that you need for your case. And the fact that it resides on somebody's hard drive doesn't mean you shouldn't make all reasonable efforts to get it.
Yeah, and the thing that strikes me, and let's talk a little bit about processing now and e-discovery and how these costs might fit in the statute, but that by processing, you can make intelligent decisions without looking at the data of certain types of file types, et cetera, that you don't want to go to the expense of putting into whatever form and producing. It's a more efficient way of copying. I mean, it gives you the ability to be intelligent. Why don't you talk about your perspective of processing and how these costs might fit into the statute?
Well, when you think about, we use the word processing, but in today's world, processing and copying are really the same thing. Getting the information from the client to the opposing party in its original form. That is a copy. Give the other side what you have and copy it. All right. Well, now in order to do that, and also I should say, the courts do look in a sense of what was reasonable copying costs. So you can't make 15 copies of documents and give it to the other side where there are thousands of duplicates and you made no attempt to eliminate that. So inherent in the concept of copying, even before, was to take reasonable steps to minimize the costs. What we have now is the ability to minimize the cost through processing, and it's relatively inexpensive, through eliminating all the duplicates that are there, eliminating files that obviously have nothing to do with the case because they're really files that are germane to the operation of the computer systems, not the case themselves. There are lots of ways to reduce the size of the information that you're giving to the other side. That benefits everybody. And we're getting more and more sophisticated processes to reduce the size. If you can reduce the size of the amount of information, you reduce the cost, and you reduce the ability of having the information available for trial and having trials because you're not inundated with hundreds of thousands of, the equivalent of hundreds of thousands of pages.
Now, you mentioned the split of opinion around courts in the U.S. and what costs can be recovered. Do you care to talk about some of the cases that are out there that talk about cost recovery?
Sure. I think if you think about it, there are really three kinds of cases. A number of cases, especially in the Eastern District of Virginia, which really view costs as very narrowly. They literally talk about it in terms of copying, download the information onto a disk, whatever that cost is. Very, very conservative. Other courts, especially those where the e-discovery process has gotten completely out of control, the Lockheed Martin case that I cite in my article, where literally because of fights between counsel, you had millions of dollars spent on e-discovery. The court felt that, as being a human being, if you will, and seeing how unfair it was, that the losing party should pay for all this nonsense. So that's the other end of the spectrum. Now you have the middle cases where the courts are trying to grapple with processing costs that look, smell like copying and should be recoverable, and others, to their eye, that really are not kind of like copying. Let me give you an example. In the two major cases that I talk about in my article, the RICO case out of the Federal Circuit and Race Tires out of the Third Circuit, both set of judges on appeal agreed that taking information that was in one kind of an electronic file and converting it to another kind of electronic file called TIFF was recoverable. But that's processing. You have to process into TIFF, and it's not inexpensive. It's not like 20 cents a page. It's a lot more. No dispute. Once you start getting to different kinds of processing, then the courts are trying to figure out, does this fit into copying? And it's this line drawing that is creating a problem. For example, in the RICO case, which was a patent case, the court agreed that where the parties had agreed to create a database to cooperate, those, the costs of hiring a third-party vendor to process the information was a copying cost. That's a good decision because it encourages parties to cooperate to reduce the overall costs of the case. In the Third Circuit case, Race Tires, they said that that, in essence, was not a copying cost, that it was not something that was recoverable. I thought they took too narrow a view. That case, they petitioned for cert in that case. Whether it will be granted, we'll have to see. And said that the creation of databases, for example, was not copying, even though it was an essential step in the transmittal of information. So those are where the cases are at the moment. There will be more law as we go along. But one of the problems that we have is that sometimes judges, and that's the fault of the practitioners, don't really understand the steps that are taken to process information. And they can't explain it so that they understand that it really is copying, not just simply a tool to review information for substance, which is the attorney's job, and that is clearly not cost recoverable.
So you started giving some of the steps that you thought that that you should do to try to recover costs at the beginning. And in your article, you listed six steps, and I counted you gave three at the beginning of knowing the law of your jurisdiction, understanding the costs. Do you want to sort of complete the list now that we've gone through some law and some of the statute? Or?
Okay, I listed three of them. And let me go through all of them because they're all related. Very, very quickly. We talked about knowing the law of your jurisdiction, and that includes the local rules. Considering, number two, consider offers of judgment. That must be given offers of judgment at the beginning of the case or early on in the case. And there are other rules that involve an offer of judgment, but you've got to think about it as a way to make it clear to the other side that you are going to want your cost back. And if they insist upon making unreasonable demands that cost you a lot of money, they do that at their peril. I think we talked about the record keeping part. And the other problem that frankly perplexed me is that the courts want agreements among the parties. In the RICO case, the court said, since you had an agreement as to how to handle these e-discovery costs, those are no longer costs. So you've got to understand if you enter an agreement with the other side, you got to structure that agreement so it's as clear as you can be, but that doesn't mean you're not going to ask for them as costs at the end. I think, and this is critical all the way through, educating the court on the cost of e-discovery right from the beginning of the case. E-discovery is not something that you should be thinking about 5 months into a case. You've got to start educating the judge early on as to why this is expensive, unreasonable, or whatever. Because do not assume that judges understand it or want to understand it. But your job as counsel is to do just that. If you're finding, the next step, next point, if you're finding that the costs that are being asked or the matters that are being requested are just so unreasonable. You've got to go in for protective orders. And next, case management orders. And so that it's a process that the court sees is going on and is reasonable, and that they view this as being fair. Judges are human beings. If they think something is unfair, they're not going to award the costs. If they think you've done it in a reasonable manner through case management orders, communication, then they will be much more sympathetic to costs at the end of the case. So those are the things to be thinking about as you're trying to recover your costs.
You know, Mark, I just thought of something here, and it's a timely issue given a lot that's happening in your neck of the woods. There's an ethics opinion on vendors versus lawyers, in the practice of law and what a vendor can say. And this is a topic for another podcast at some point, I hope soon. But it seems to me that if you're tracking your costs, if your law firm, your lawyer is tracking your costs, not only does it give them an advantage to sign off if they're tracking each step of the process for certification that they've completed the process, but to make proportionality arguments, to say, hey, we have to stop. This all ties into legal strategy. You may, try to do an effective cost containment strategy, but you might be cutting your law firm off at the knees if they're not getting access to that information to weave it into the case. I mean, don't you think those are some interesting issues?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the difference between the practice of law now and the line between practicing law and e-discovery, and especially with e-discovery vendors, is getting very, very soft. And we don't know where these lines are being drawn. And you may get opinions out of bar associations that what vendors are doing is practicing law. And what you thought you were practicing law really is something that vendors do. And it's all tied into law firm economics as well. And how this works. Should the law firm have its own e-discovery shop as a subsidiary affiliate? How does that work? What are conflicts of interest that could that generate? It's a changing field from an economics point of view.
Yep. I'm going to dip back into processing just a little bit more before we end the show. And, you cited the RAND study in your analysis, which, again, I think everyone should be reading. And you noted that the processing charges range from a low of 10% to a high of 40% of the total e-discovery cases on a particular matter. That can be a significant cost. I thought that was worth noting as an example of keeping track of things that you might be able to get back for your client. But where I wanted to go with this is, since my space that I focus in is in predictive coding, if you look at, the RAND study where 70 cents on the dollar for review is something that RAND is critical of to say that we need to attack this. If you use predictive coding tools, you're oftentimes going to spend even more on processing as a percentage of the total costs incurred. And even though they're increasing, their increases are recovered by the savings from review. So does this potential evolution hold out even more hope for cost recovery if parties adopt predictive coding and use some of your creative arguments?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, in many cases, law firms and clients, when they first start thinking about predictive coding, which is certainly the most important development that's we're talking about these days, they say, "Oh, the predictive coding costs are high," and I'm not sure we want to do that. As the RAND study made abundantly clear, while processing costs are expensive, it is the reviewing costs that are the killers. So from a company's point of view, if they can reduce the amount of information through predictive coding, And frankly, predictive coding is the whole concept is another program that I encourage you to do, and what it really is and what it means. But it is, I believe in the future, it will be essential. And that since it will cost, it is a cost of processing, it is a cost of copying, and should be included in the bill of costs. And it, while the idea of, in explaining predictive coding, oh, you've got to think of these different mathematical formulas and blah, 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 it's still just copying. It's just like you did when you had a Xerox machine. The Xerox machine did a lot of stuff, too, internally. Predictive coding, yes, it's a lot of internal stuff. But I still believe that it should come within the concept of costs and helps litigation come back to where it should be now and have companies be able to try cases.
Yeah, the other thing I'll throw out there in terms of the costs is anyone who's ever studied economics knows that there's a real strong correlation between demand and costs. And we're at the beginning stage of these newer tools. And if you survey around the country, and I've been doing this, and you look at, you know, different vendors and different, you know, what different companies are doing, you will see that there's not a lot of activity. There's a lot of talk. There's really not a lot of activity. So maybe there's 400 cases in the country being done this, and that might be high, okay? Well, if more cases are pushed in this direction, these companies, it's software. Someone's going to lower the prices. The next person will lower their prices, and these costs are going to drop. I mean, these cost containment opportunities are sometimes tied very strongly to economic theory. And, you know, that's my prediction in the next couple of years. These costs are going to drop rather quickly, you know, as people use it more. But anyway, again, as we said, that's another topic for another day. But I'll give you one more shot at this topic if you want, Mark, or any topic. I like to end this show with, you know, this helps me plan future shows. When I have an expert, I like to always ask, you know, here we're on July 12, 2012, what issues do you see out there? What issue do you see is the biggest issue in e-discovery right now? And who knows, I might do another show on this topic. So,
well, it is really the judicial and practicing attorney education on what is and what can be done. And cooperation. Those are the big issues, and how we accomplish this is very difficult. How do we have now a basic shift in the adversary process from one of objecting to whatever anybody else says to one of trying to figure out a solution. And there must be education of the attorneys, and it must start in law schools as to what all of this is so they can do it intelligently without prejudicing their clients. I believe, while it's not technically a legal issue, how we educate attorneys so they will cooperate and use the rules of proportionality is a critical issue for the bar.
You know, I'll sign up for that one. Given all the work we do here with the podcasting as a hobby, and you know, others that blog, and I blog a little bit, but I agree with you completely. That's a good, nice broad way to capture all the issues that are out there. So I want to thank you, Mark, for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have guests like yourself share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can remember the show and website phonetically, as it sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.